The Church of God the Eternal presents The Significance of Two Counts, a message by Mr. John Brisby for the afternoon service of the day of Pentecost. Monday, May 29th, 2023.
It is a pleasure to address all of you on this high holy day of Pentecost. This is, yes, the one true day of Pentecost. It is a Monday. And because you understand that, and because you're keeping this day, you are among the few at this time who are actually showing the proper respect and honor for God. Now, there were many out there who were confused and they don't know and they've just followed what the ministers of their particular affiliations have told them, and so they're keeping a Sunday or whatever. And so we look forward to the time when God is going to do a grand work, which he's promised to do, and to open the minds of many to see the truth concerning this and other holy days, so that they can indeed worship God in spirit and truth. In the meantime, you're among the few who have a chance to do it right. And by gathering together on this day, then you are following God's command to appear before him on a day which he has made holy. So we're going to talk this afternoon about the two different distinct counts that God gave for Pentecost. Now, I'm going to try to avoid getting into a big technicality about counting. I'm going to talk about the count of Leviticus 23 and the separate count of Deuteronomy 16. For the purpose of emphasizing the spiritual intent, God gave two distinct counts for Pentecost. One in Leviticus 23 is a count of 50. The other in Deuteronomy 16 is only a count of 49. Why are there two different counts? God doesn't do anything for no reason. So he was very intent on revealing Pentecost and describing it with two separate distinct counts, and both of them matter. So what I want to show to you today is a reminder that we really have grown in our knowledge of the revealed truth. God gave, through Mr. Herbert Armstrong in the early 20th century, the building blocks of that revealed way of life, which was the establishment of the church. And it was established with Jesus Christ as the cornerstone, as we're going to see. And so that truth was given, and Monday Pentecost was a part of that truth. But I will also tell you that God did not choose to reveal the fullness of the spiritual magnitude concerning the counts to Mr. Armstrong. Oh, the meaning of Pentecost as representing the gift of the Holy Spirit to the church? Absolutely, and that's most important of all. But let me read to you from June 8, 1943, item from Mr. Herbert Armstrong in the Good News. And this is very early days, 1943. And it was an article he wrote entitled, How to Figure Pentecost. Here's what he said. Literally, the Greek word Pentecost means 50 count. Now, I'll stop right there and say there's a number of these other ministers and other groups who are teaching their members that Pentecost means 50th day. No, it does not. It's just what Mr. Armstrong said here. Literally, the Greek word Pentecost means 50 count. Count 50. In the Hebrew of the Old Testament, the word Pentecost is not used. Pentecost is a Greek word used only after the Jews of Palestine came to speak the common language of the time, Greek. Originally, he says, in the Hebrew, this festival was called primarily by two names, Feast of First Fruits and Feast of Weeks, because it counted by numbering 7 weeks from the morrow after the Sabbath and then adding one day to make 50. Now I'm going to stop right there. You see, what Mr. Armstrong understood, he understood the right day because God showed him Monday. And he's referring to both counts in Leviticus 23 and in Deuteronomy 16, which we're going to read. But rather than recognizing or emphasizing that there was a difference in those two counts, one's a count of 50 and one's a count of 49, he treated them as if they were virtually the same. One's a count of 50 and one's a count of 49 plus one. That's what he said here. He goes on to say, hence, in the Hebrew, the festival was named Feast of Weeks, signifying 7 weeks were counted from Sunday to the morrow after that seventh week, or to a Monday, while in the New Testament it was named Pentecost, meaning count 50 days from a Sunday, morrow after the Sabbath, to a Monday, all caps. So the most important element is he understood Pentecost was Monday, and that's what the entire church kept then from the mid to late 1930s all the way up until 1974. And I'm telling you, my dear friends, that this was the Church of God, not the Church of Herbert Armstrong, and God made sure that the church got Pentecost right. It had nothing to do with Herbert Armstrong and his scholarly abilities, his understanding of Greek and Hebrew. It had to do with the revelation of God to make sure that we got the simple truth so that we could observe all that God commands us to do and do it correctly. And so for all of those years, the church assembled on a Monday. And I'm telling you, that is the right day. But concerning the counts, so what we find here is Mr. Armstrong emphasized it's the Feast of Weeks. Let's notice that in Deuteronomy 16, verse 16. Here we have the command for the offerings that are to be brought on those particular times that God commands, and it's 3 times in a year. Deuteronomy 16:16 says, 3 times in a year shall all thy males appear before the Eternal thy God in the place which he shall choose. What are those three? In the Feast of Unleavened Bread and in the Feast of Weeks. So here is a reference to Pentecost, and again, substantiating that God calls it the Feast of Weeks. And in the Feast of Tabernacles, and they shall not appear before the Eternal empty. All right, so there's one place where we find the Pentecost is called the Feast of Weeks. What is this feast about? What is its focus? What is its purpose in the plan of God? This feast is all about first fruits. Notice that in Exodus 34, verse 22. Exodus 34, 22 says, thou shalt observe the Feast of Weeks. So here's another reference. Thou shalt observe the Feast of Weeks of the first fruits of wheat harvest. So here we find that first fruits is connected very much with this Feast of Weeks. Now, first fruit of wheat harvest, and that's not wheat like we call it, a specific variety of grain. This is actually a Hebrew word that means grain in a broader sense, which, and the early harvest, by the way, in Palestine was barley. So what we call wheat was a later summer crop. So this is the Feast of Weeks of the first fruits of grain harvest, if you will, and the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end, which is the Feast of Tabernacles. So here's again a reference to Pentecost. It's the Feast of Weeks, and it has to do with the first fruits of the grain harvest. Now, what does that matter? And what significance does that have in God's plan? Well, I think we understand that first fruits is the topic here when we're talking about God calling you and me and all of those now with an understanding of his truth. Those who are part of the first or the second covenant now in preparation for the second coming of Jesus Christ, that small early harvest relates to the work of God with only a few at this time. That Feast of Ingathering then refers it to the great harvest of humanity when God, through Jesus Christ and his rule upon this earth, and that which is signified by the last great day, the great white throne judgment, all that has to do now with is bringing in the harvest of millions and billions, which has to do with that fall harvest. But first fruits has to do with the early small crop and harvest, and that signifies the early work that God is doing right now upon this earth with only a few that he's called out of the world. And in that regard, now we have two separate commands by God to count, and there's a reason for it. And I would tell you that we gained our insight into this much more by the ministry of Mr. Raymond Cole. Through Mr. Armstrong, we received the foundation. It is a Monday. Counting is important. It has to do with first fruits. It is the Feast of Weeks. Through Mr. Raymond Cole, we gained an insight, because God inspired him, that's absolutely what we believe, to understand the distinction in these two counts and their meaning. And there is a spiritual meaning for it. So let's go back to Deuteronomy 16 again. And now verse 9 and 10, which is where we find the command for counting Pentecost. Here we find 7 weeks shalt thou number. So what's the count? Numbering is counting. This is a count of 7 weeks. And how do you count 7 weeks? Well, how many days are in a week? 7. So if you have 7 weeks and a week is 7 days, 7 times 7 is 49. Pretty simple, right? So what's the count? 49. 7 weeks shalt thou number unto thee. Begin to number the 7 weeks. So we have a total number of days in the count. And now God also commands us in where to start the count. Because you can't count and end up at the right day for Pentecost unless you have the number of the count and you know when to start. 7 weeks thou shalt number unto thee, begin to number the 7 weeks from such time as thou begins to put the sickle to the corn. When is that? Well, I'll hold you off on that because we are going to come back to this, but not until after I go through that other count in Leviticus 23. But for the time being, I just want to get through this now, verse 10. And thou shalt keep the Feast of Weeks unto the Eternal thy God with a tribute of a freewill offering of thy hand, which thou shalt give unto the Eternal thy God according as the Eternal thy God hath blessed thee. So it is one of the high Sabbaths, an annual feast. It's determined, the only one that's determined by counting. Every other holy day of God is given a date on the Hebrew calendar. Pentecost is the only one that you must find by counting. And therefore, it's the only one that always falls on the same day of the week, which is a Monday. All right, so we find here Deuteronomy 16 is a count of 7 weeks, 49 days, not a day longer. 49 is 49. Now flip over with me to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, verse 15 and 16, and here's the other command to count. Leviticus 23, 15, and ye shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering. We're going to find out more about that. And what are we counting? 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Is that the command to count? No. We haven't seen the command to count yet. Here's a statement, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Now, again, Mr. Armstrong seemed to have kind of glossed over the significance and connected it to the Deuteronomy 16 count of 7 weeks. But unlike Deuteronomy 16, where it said count 7 weeks, this doesn't say count 7 weeks. It just says, in the course of your counting, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Now, the scholars all want to debate, is this Sabbaths Saturdays, like holy Sabbath days, weekly Sabbaths, or is this a week? Because you see, the word in the Hebrew can refer to either one. It can refer to Saturdays, or it can refer to 7-day weeks. So all the scholars want to debate what it means. But in its simplicity, all this is saying is that seven Sabbaths, and I'm going to interpret it as Saturdays, will be included in this period of counting. Because there's one Saturday for every week, and if you're counting at least 7 weeks, you're going to get seven Saturdays. But I emphasize again, we have not yet seen the command for counting, which compares to the count that we just read in Deuteronomy 16. You get that here in verse 16 of Leviticus 23. Seven Sabbaths shall be complete, even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath shall ye number. Now we finally get the instruction to number something, to count something. And what are we counting? Even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath shall ye number 50 days. And ye shall offer a meat offering unto the Eternal. How many days are in this count? It is 50. Isn't that very specific? Ye number 50 days. And I'm telling you, my dear friends, even if it seems overly simplistic, 50 is not 49. And 49 is not 50. The Deuteronomy 16 count says number 7 weeks, which is 49 and only 49. And this doesn't say to number 7 weeks. It says number 50 days. Do you see the difference? And again, I emphasize to you that our understanding of why God did this did grow through the ministry of Mr. Raymond Cole. But I will emphasize to you also that this is a classic example of what God means, that we are to grow in grace and knowledge. And all these other groups and their ministers use that as an opportunity to dismantle the truth of the past, to say what was true before is not true now. So they're growing, quote unquote, in grace and in knowledge by changing what they used to do and going to something totally different. That's not what we do. Because Jesus Christ revealed the truth and it's a foundation, and then that spiritual growth, which he promised to give to his true church, adds to, augments, it never takes away or contradicts that which you have in the foundation. So Mr. Armstrong had the truth of a Monday Pentecost and its significance as first fruits and what it means for God's work with this early harvest of the church before the return of Jesus Christ. But through Raymond Cole, years later, we receive the growth in the understanding of the two different counts that God gave to get to that one holy day of Pentecost. And it is an understanding of the difference in the 49 count versus the 50 count. They are not the same count. So what is the explanation? All right. We're going to read again here in Leviticus 23, emphasizing the fact that Jesus Christ is the first of the first fruits. If Pentecost is about first fruits, and we've already seen that, Jesus Christ himself is the very first of God's first fruits harvest with the New Testament church today. And that, my dear friends, is the answer in the back of the book about why the 50 count, which is, by the way, different than the 49 count of Deuteronomy 16. We'll get to that. But let's read verse 15 and 16 here in Leviticus 23 again with this in mind. You shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering. Well, that's a Sunday. It follows a weekly Sabbath. Oh, and by the way, this is debated by the Jews who don't believe the morrow after the Sabbath. They think that Sabbath is the first high day of unleavened bread, which can fall on any number of days in the week, which is one of their serious errors. And I'm not getting into the technicalities on that, but I'm just telling you that it is a weekly Sabbath, and it's the weekly Sabbath that falls during the 7 days of unleavened bread. There's only one Saturday that ever falls within the 7 days of unleavened bread, and that is Wave Sheaf Sunday. Well, that's the day That's the Sabbath that falls within the 7 days of unleavened bread from which we derive Wave Sheaf Sunday, which is the day following. By the way, even when that Sunday falls outside of unleavened bread itself, it's the Sabbath. That's part of the revelation we got through Mr. Armstrong as well, that must be within the 7 days of unleavened bread. And then the day following, which is a Sunday, is Wave Sheaf Sunday. Wave Sheaf Sunday puts a spotlight upon Jesus Christ himself, because he symbolically was the wave offering. From the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete, even unto the morrow, after the seventh Sabbath shall ye number 50 days. All right, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15, I'll begin in verse 19, because I'm going to confirm to you now the significance of this principle of first fruits and the wave sheaf offering. 1 Corinthians 15, beginning in verse 19, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable. But now is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept. So here we find a direct reference to Jesus Christ as the first fruits. And that makes sense, right? He was the very first human being ever to complete the salvation process, to be changed into immortality and to become again, well, for him, again, part of the God family. He was a member of that God family from time immemorial. He had no beginning, but he had divested himself of that glory, was born of a human mother, and becoming fully human as well as divine, because God was his father, not a man. He was the first one then who actually was transformed in his death, resurrected by God the Father, and then sits now at the right hand of his Father on that throne. So he became immortal, having been in the flesh. And he's the first one to go through that process. It's the same process that God is going to offer to all human beings upon this earth in their appointed time. But he was the first. Now, we call him the first of the first fruits because he wasn't the only first fruit. Here, we just read, it calls him the first fruits of them that slept. So you could stop right there and think, well, that's it. Christ is the first fruits. There's no one else who's a first fruit. That's not true. I'll show that to you. But what Paul was inspired to write right here at this moment for reason is that Christ then becomes the first fruits of them that slept. Continuing on verse 21, for since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive, but every man in his own order. And this is the thing that many so-called Christians do not understand. They presume that salvation is offered to every human being alive on the earth right now. And so they're out doing their missionary works trying to save everybody, believing that if you don't say the magic words, I accept Jesus Christ as my personal Savior, if you don't do that before you die, you end up burning forever in hellfire. So they're out trying to save everyone because they have no clue concerning the times of salvation which God revealed in the Bible. This is one of the texts that proves it. Every man in his own order, meaning by God's design, people have their chance when God says, and not before. And the majority of human beings are not being offered salvation right now. They're blinded by God for a reason. Only a few are being called now, enlightened, given an opportunity to be baptized, to receive the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, and being held accountable for then bearing spiritual fruit. And you and I are a part of that, my dear friends. The early harvest, because this is our time in the order. But every man in his own order, Christ the first fruits, afterward they that are Christ at his coming. We'll get to that momentarily. But right now I want to emphasize the fact that it says Christ the first fruits. So again, if you just read 1 Corinthians 15:19 through 23, you might think, well, Christ is the only one that's called first fruit. I'm going to show you know he's the first of the first fruits. But again, we're explaining the Leviticus 23 count of 50 to arrive at the right day for Pentecost. And the beginning day for the count is a Sunday. And that Sunday, which is God's commanded wave sheaf day, is all about Jesus Christ. It puts the spotlight on him. So we know that Christ would not be called first if there was not also something that follows. It didn't say he was the only fruit. It said he was the first. And if there's a first, then there must be at least a second. Romans 8, verse 28 and 29. Let's look at that. Romans 8, beginning in verse 28, we read, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son." And there is predestination, another sticking point for the majority of these ministers who came out of our parent organization, who have all embraced a lie, because they changed that doctrine as well in the early 1970s. In the Worldwide Church of God, another topic. But you were, my dear friends, known by God before the foundation of the world, and that means the person that you would be today, unique from every other human being that has ever been born or will be born. God knew who you would be. Now, these others go into conniptions about that. But the simple wording here can be taken as a fact. Whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to conform to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. So again, Christ is called the first fruits because he's not the only fruit. In the plan of God, he was only the first of many to come, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Many brethren who are going to walk in his footsteps at the time of their calling, whenever that is, early or late, with the opportunity then also to be transformed into immortality and to join that great God family and to live forever with offices as kings and priests. That's what this is all about. So he was only the first. He was the forerunner. He paved the way to make it possible for many others to go through that same process according to the plan and purposes of God. And Christ's role as the wave sheaf confirms also that he is the very first. Let's go back to Leviticus 23 now. Now we're going to read verses 10 and 11, which gives us that context. Leviticus 23, verse 10, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when you be come into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then ye shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priests." So here was a command for a special ceremony that all Israelites were required to do. And so whenever that early harvest, typically barley, was ready to be reaped, they couldn't just go out and start harvesting. They had to first do this religious ceremony. When was it? We already saw it's on a Sunday, which is why we call it Wave Sheaf Sunday. What was its significance? A small sheaf was cut out of that new grain and then taken to the appointed place for one of the Levitical priests then to actually perform this ceremony for that family from their harvest. And no one could start their harvest with God's favor without going through this process. So why did God do it? What's the meaning? Because that small cutting called the wave, That initial sheaf called the wave sheaf was that which pictured Jesus Christ and his role as the first in the harvest of God. The first of many brethren to follow, but that initial cutting to go through this ceremony on that Sunday that follows the weekly Sabbath during the 7 days of unleavened bread was all about focusing on Christ's qualification to be our high priests. Verse 11, he shall wave the sheaf before the Eternal to be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. So it's about Jesus Christ being accepted for you. That means becoming our high priest. And by becoming our high priest, becoming an intercessor with us and the Father and all that goes with it. I'm not going to get into the details of that. Otherwise, this sermon would be way too long. But during the time of the first covenant, then it was the house of Aaron and the Levites now who were fulfilling this role. But after the death of Jesus Christ, that priesthood changed, and it was no longer now the Levitical priesthood, but now, as you will find in the entire book of Hebrews, now we have a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So the priesthood changed. When and how? The priesthood changed now that Jesus Christ, not a human being, became our high priest, our advocate, the one that allows us and permits our direct contact with the Father by his perfect sacrifice. So after his resurrection, and when was Jesus Christ resurrected? It was on a Saturday night, right at sunset, because his tomb was sealed on a Wednesday. Wednesday evening at sunset, and that's when the 72-hour clock began. He was in that tomb precisely 3 days and three nights, 72 hours, beginning Wednesday evening at sunset, which means 72 hours later was Saturday night at sunset. That's when he was resurrected. But was that the end of the story just by him being resurrected? Oh, no. Notice John 20, verse 16 and 17. Here is an account on Sunday morning early when Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and found that the stone was rolled away and the tomb was empty. And here Jesus Christ, now the resurrected Jesus Christ, he's no longer human, he died. His Father resurrected him Saturday evening. Here's Sunday morning now, which is why all the, you know, Catholics and Protestants say he was resurrected on Sunday morning. No, the tomb was found empty on Sunday morning. He had already been resurrected hours before, the previous evening. Here, John 20, verse 16, Jesus said unto her, Mary, she turned herself and said unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. Jesus saith unto her, Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. Well, what's all that about? Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. Isn't it interesting that this was happening on the Sunday following the weekly Sabbath during unleavened bread? Not a coincidence at all, because it was indeed Wave Sheaf Sunday, the same day that God commanded to ancient Israel to bring that small cutting, that symbolic cutting of the entire harvest, the initial one to go through this special ceremony on that Sunday following the weekly Sabbath during unleavened bread. And here was Jesus Christ now on that Sunday morning after his resurrection the night before, telling Mary, don't touch me, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. He says, but go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father and to my God and to your God. And you see with the other Gospel writers, you put all the pieces together, I'm not doing that now, that he was going to ascend to his Father, but that wasn't a one and only ascension. the final ascension, if you will, that was an interim ascension to his Father's throne, and then he was coming back. And that's exactly what happened. Turn with me to Luke 24, verse 35, because here we find later on the same day, Wave Sheaf Sunday, not early in the morning now, but now it's Sunday evening. After he had now walked on the road with these disciples and he didn't allow them to know who he was, let's read the account here. Luke 24, verse 35, they told what things these two men, once he did open their eyes to see them. I'm not going through that. You can read that yourself. Now they run as quickly as they can back to find the disciples who are gathered together to tell them what happened. They told what things were done in the way, how he was known to them in breaking of bread. And as they thus spake, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them and saith unto them, peace be unto you. So here they are all gathered together, locked behind closed doors in the evening for fear of persecution by the Jews. And all of a sudden, Jesus Christ appears in their midst. How? He didn't have to go through a door. He was a spirit being now. No longer flesh and blood, so he just materialized in their midst. And saith unto them, peace be unto you. Verse 37, but they were terrified and affrighted. Yeah. How many of them really believed everything that he had taught them before he died? That he had to be lifted up to fulfill the prophecy, but then he would see them again and go before them into Galilee. You see, they didn't really believe it. Now they're coming to. They were terrified and affrighted and supposed that they had seen a spirit. And he said unto them, why are you troubled? Why do thoughts arise in your hearts? Behold my hands and my feet, that it is myself. Handle me and see. Which is the point of me giving you this text. What does this have to do with Wave Sheaf and first fruits? On Sunday morning, he told Mary not to touch him because he had not yet ascended to his Father. And now, on the evening, just a few hours later, on the very same day, he's allowing the disciples to touch him. Why? What happened? Something must have occurred in the interim hours between the morning meeting and this evening meeting. It is myself, handle me and see, for a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as you see me have. And the other accounts put it together show that he, even though he was immortal now, and he was spirit, not flesh, but he manifested himself to these disciples with a flesh body that they could touch. One of the attributes of God, and by the way, God's holy angels, is that they can, to fulfill God's will, materialize or manifest themselves with material bodies. The demons, by the way, can't do that. No evidence that a demon, a fallen angel, can materialize physically. Oh, people can see what they think are demons in their mind, but that's not reality. It's part of the deception of Satan. So here Jesus Christ is physically showing himself with a body, even though he's not really flesh and blood. And he's manifesting himself with the wounds that his flesh and blood body had received by the crucifixion, with holes in his hands, in his feet. And, by the way, also the hole in his side where he was pierced. He can materialize as God in any way he wants. He chose to materialize in a way that would help convince these disciples that it was him. But again, the critical point is the fact that they were able to touch him. And hours before, he said, don't touch me. What happened? Sometime after he saw Mary Magdalene, he did ascend to his Father's throne and went through the true Wave Sheaf ceremony. To be accepted by the Father to take on the position of high priest for you and me. We're given no details about that, But when you put, as Mr. Armstrong taught us to do, you know, let the Bible interpret the Bible, so we put the commands to Israel concerning Pentecost and this wave sheaf count to arrive at Pentecost, and we find that Jesus Christ absolutely fulfilled it. We already saw that it was about him being accepted for us. So that's what wave sheaf is all about. The introduction of an intercessor to break down the barrier that has kept us cut off from God the Father, which is why at his death that veil in the temple ripped from top to bottom, to signify finally by his perfect life in the flesh and his death fulfilling his Father's will, was made possible now the reconciliation between man and God. It didn't happen automatically, because he had to go through the wave sheaf ceremony to be accepted by the Father now as the new high priest, to transition away from the priesthood of Aaron to now the priesthood of Melchizedek. And now once Jesus Christ was certified by his Father in heaven as our new high priest, then he returned. And that's then when we have the interactions that Sunday evening that we're talking about now, where he did allow his disciples to touch him, because he had been sanctified by the Father in the interim, and now fully filling the role of high priest, now he manifested himself and did the final instruction to his disciples for the next 40 days before his final ascension to his Father's throne, where he sits on the right hand. But it began with the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf was significant. So what's the purpose of the 50 count in Leviticus 23? It's to focus a spotlight on this role of Jesus Christ as the first, and his certification, acceptance as our high priest. That's what that wave sheaf Sunday is all about. So when you're celebrating, when you're using the 50 count of Leviticus 23, beginning the count on that Sunday, the day following the weekly Sabbath, you're beginning your count with the anchor point of Jesus Christ, recognizing him as your high priest, sanctified by God through that wave sheaf ceremony, which is what gives us our hope of salvation. And he was the first, but the first of many brethren who are going to follow, with the opportunity also to gain immortality. Now let's go back to 1 Corinthians 15:23. Because there's a prelude to talking about the 49 count of Deuteronomy 16. We want to, again, focus on 1 Corinthians 15:23. Here we read, "But every man in his own order, Christ the first fruits," we read that, "afterward they that are Christ at his coming." So who are we talking about? Well, who has an opportunity to be added to the God family at his coming? You see, this is very specific. This isn't talking about the end of the salvation plan pictured by Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day. He comes at a time pictured by the Feast of Trumpets. And who is it that is going to be added to the God family when he appears? Who rise to meet him in the air, having been changed from physical into spiritual, and now take their position with the army of God? Those who were successful through the first fruit harvest, the church today. Those who either died in the faith or are alive at his appearing. And again, I'm not going through to focus on that. I just want to put wave sheaf and our role for Pentecost in context of these other truths that we know. So, who are these here? Christ the first fruits, afterward they that are Christ at his coming. This isn't the rest of the world. This is talking about the ones who who are added to the God family at the second coming of Jesus Christ. As he comes to take possession of the earth and to rule for 1,000 years, and then to finish the plan for that period of time following. So we're talking about the New Testament church. So Christ is the first fruits. And so who follows? The church. The church today of which you and I are a part. So in this analogy, Christ is the first fruits of them that slept, and the church at his coming is the greater harvest, quote unquote. Not the final great harvest of souls, but in this context, the greater harvest compared to the one, Jesus Christ, who is the first. But guess what? All the ones we're talking about are still first fruits. Christ is called first fruits, but so are the rest of these being referred to that are going to be glorified at his coming. Can I prove that? Sure. James 1 verse 18 for one. James 1 verse 18 says, of his own will beget he us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So now the focus here is not on Jesus Christ as being the first fruits, but as those who are glorified through the work of the New Testament church. They are called first fruits. Now, wait a minute. Is Christ the first fruits, or is this assembly of people called to be in the church first fruits? Yes, both of them. They're all legitimately called first fruits, which is why we refer to Jesus Christ as the first of the first fruits. That we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures or his creation work, which means now in the grand scheme of offering salvation to all humanity, the time order is that only a very few are given that opportunity today, or in the past 2,000 years since the New Testament church began. They are all the first fruits. Jesus Christ, then called first fruits, is the first of the first fruits. Revelation 14, verse 4 also. Revelation 14, verse 4 says, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. Who, speaking of these that died as martyrs, they are called first fruits, the early harvest, comparable to that smaller barley harvest, which is reaped now at the end of the spring. Very distinct from the great harvest after the summer, which is reaped in the fall. So you see, first fruits is very significant. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes. These were redeemed from among men. That means they were glorified. They were changed from physical into spirit. They actually succeeded in being born into the God family. That's what redemption really means. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. So again, these who are first to be glorified at the second coming of Jesus Christ are themselves called first fruits. And Jesus Christ himself is called first fruits. It's not a contradiction. They're all first fruits. Now let's go to Deuteronomy 16 again. Here in Deuteronomy 16, we have the specific count. And as I've already emphasized, very distinct from the Leviticus 23 count. Let's read it again in this context. Deuteronomy 16, verse 9. 7 weeks shalt thou number. That's 49. 49 days is this count. 7 weeks shalt thou number unto thee. Begin to number the 7 weeks from such time as thou beginnest to put the sickle to the corn. Remember, I passed over that before. I said we'd get back to it. Here we are. When is this day that you begin to put the sickle to the corn? Well, many say, the first time you put the sickle to the corn is when you cut that small sheaf in order to have the wave sheaf ceremony on Sunday. They will argue. So this must be referring also to Sunday, wave sheaf day. You count 49 days from wave sheaf Sunday, because that's when you first put the sickle, even just one small sheaf, to cut, to take it, to have the wave sheaf ceremony. Is that a true conclusion? No, it is not. How do I prove that? I emphasize again, because 49 is not 50, and 50 is not 49. The 50 count of Leviticus 23, we already saw, begins with Sunday, wave sheaf day. That's day one of the count. And then you count 50, and then keep Pentecost. This one is not a count of 50, it is a count of 49, and yet it also leads to Pentecost. 7 weeks is 49 days, 49 is not 50. Pentecost is one and only one day, right? How can a count of 50 and a count of 49 both land upon the same day? How do two different counts of different lengths point you to the same one and only day of Pentecost? It's only possible if the starting point of the count is one day different. And I like to describe this for simplicity as if you've got a piece of string and it's a certain length. And let's say you've got one piece of string. I'm going to use inches because I'm American. And we're going to say 50 inches long. All right? And you've got a separate piece of string and it's 49 inches long. There's an inch different, right? They're not the same length. But you line up these two pieces of string so that the end of the string is the same. When you line up one edge or one end of each of those strings together, what does the other side look like? Because one is shorter than the other, right? So on one end, you've got an overhang. You've got one shorter than the other. That's how I think about the counts. How can a 50-day count and a 40-day, 49-day count both end to point you to the one and only day of Pentecost? It must be true that the day you start counting from is different. It's the only conclusion. Why would that be? See, this was an element that Mr. Armstrong did not see. God did not reveal it. It wasn't necessary at that time in the church history. He revealed to Mr. Armstrong that Pentecost was Monday. And we had enough of his explanation for the significance of first fruits and the wave sheaf to have everything that we needed. But years later, through Mr. Raymond Cole, we got more knowledge about the distinction in these two counts. And what does it mean when you have a 50 count and a 49 count that both terminate in pointing you to Pentecost? It means your starting day is different. And why? Because the 50 count of Leviticus 23 focuses on Jesus Christ as the first of the first fruits. What does this Deuteronomy 16 count of 49 then focus on? Its focus is not on Jesus Christ and wave sheaf day. Because day one of that count is not Sunday, but Monday. It's the only way that a 49 count can end at the same place where the 50 count terminates. The 50 count begins on Sunday. The 49 count must begin a day later on Monday. No other way. And what does that mean? God did it for a reason. Because again, you're part of the first fruits. The meaning, my dear friends, of the Deuteronomy 16 count is a celebration of you. Your role and all those who are going to be a part of the first fruits harvest of Jesus Christ at his second coming, who are called to be a part of the church of God today, either from its inception in the first century, on that first Pentecost, on Monday in 31 AD, or even down to today, as God continues to call ones out of this world and offer to them the chance to be begotten of the Holy Spirit and to prepare themselves for ultimate birth into the God family. That's all the first fruit work of God, comparable to that early barley harvest. It's only a few compared to the population of the world. It's smaller by far than the work, the harvest that's going to come, and that's why it's called first. The 49 count of Deuteronomy 16 celebrates you. The 50 count celebrates Jesus Christ. Both of them are important. All of them are part of the first fruits work of God. So that is how, in Deuteronomy 16, 9 and 10, or at 9 again, 7 weeks shalt thou number unto thee, beginning to number the 7 weeks from such time as thou beginnest to put the sickle to the corn. If you interpret that that's wave sheaf day, that it also is focusing on Jesus Christ as high priest and first of the first fruits, and you count 49 from Sunday, you're going to be one day off from your count of 50. Not getting into the inclusive or exclusive counting or the Monday versus Sunday. I'm just telling you, one is a 49 count and one is a 50 count. They are different. That means something's got to give. That's our proof that it's this such time that you begin to put the sickle to the corn is not talking about the small cutting that you take for the wave sheaf ceremony. This is talking about the first full day of harvest. After wave sheaf Sunday, once that has been fulfilled, now Monday is the first full day of labor in the fields to take in the harvest. That harvest pictures you, the first fruits of God's work, with the hope of being born into his family at Christ's second coming, before the millennium begins. So this day, that first full day of harvest, when they began to put the sickle to the corn in earnest to bring in that harvest, that's your day. Does it compete with Jesus Christ? No way. Do you see how they complement? Both counts, the 50 count of Leviticus 23 and the 49 count of Deuteronomy 16, both point to Pentecost. But one begins on Sunday, and one of necessity begins one day later on Monday. One pictures and spotlights Jesus Christ as the first of the first fruits. The second count, Deuteronomy 16, focuses on you and me and all of those who have a chance to be born into the God family as a part of that early harvest. 1 Peter 2, verse 4. 1 Peter 2, verse 4. Here we're going to find out that Jesus Christ revealed through Peter that we are all of the household of God. It's one house. 1 Peter 2, verse 4, to whom coming? As unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious, speaking of Jesus Christ. Verse 5, you also as lively stones are built up a spiritual house. So Peter was inspired to describe the church, which you are a part, as a house. Wherefore also it is contained, built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. And then verse 6, wherefore also it is contained in the scripture, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone. So again, the symbolism is about house building. And the first thing that goes down is a foundation. And the house is built upon that foundation. And Jesus Christ now is compared, in some places he's compared to the entire foundation. In this particular case, he's compared to the first stone that goes down to set the foundation, the cornerstone. Unto you therefore which believe, he's precious, but unto them which be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner. So human beings didn't appreciate Jesus Christ. the Jews who celebrated the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob actually killed him, which is how they rejected him from being the foundation of the house of God, the church. But it didn't thwart God's plan at all, because he did become the cornerstone of that house. Verse 8, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient, whereunto also they were appointed. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So, as a part of the first fruits of God's work with the human family, now you are fulfilling your role with Jesus Christ in that early work. You are part, as we already read in verse 5, the spiritual house of which he's the cornerstone. But it's all one house. Revelation 3, verse 12. Revelation 3, verse 12, him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God. Another reference to a building structure. And glorified members of God's family who come through this human experience and are transformed from flesh into spirit are described as being a part of this temple. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God. And what's the purpose of a pillar? It holds up the structure. It's a key support that has everything to do with the integrity of that temple. So those who are pillars are fulfilling very significant roles. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. All different symbols to describe this process of offering salvation to human beings. And these now who are successful in their spiritual work and who are granted forgiveness for their sins, because God sees their sincerity and their desire to crucify what they are by nature and instead become what Jesus Christ is in thinking and action, which is what it means to walk in his footsteps, then God will honor by cleansing them through the shed blood of our high priest after the order of Melchizedek, Jesus Christ himself, and therefore granting us now to be glorified forever in the God family and to be a part of that house of God, that temple, if you will. And all of it will be one unified house. Well, what does that have to do with our topic? Because I'm showing to you the significance of both Christ's role and our role as a part of that first fruit work. There's no competition. He's the head of it. He's the high priest. But he's the first of many. And he is absolutely willing to sacrifice himself for you and for me and to celebrate our success. Because that's what he did it for. So we're not competing with Christ at all. We're all part of the first fruits as he's defined it. Christ is the first of that first fruit work. And so when you understand these things, you can see the significance of two different counts. Mr. Armstrong never described it. He kind of glossed over it. It wasn't important for what the church needed at the time in the 20th century. But it has become incredibly significant to us to add to that amount of knowledge, building upon the foundation of that which was established by Christ at the beginning, magnifying, not contradicting, but adding to. How significant is it then to understand the reason that the 49 count of Deuteronomy 16 is different than the 50 count of Leviticus 23? And the fact that they both point to the same holy day, which we're keeping today, which pictures that first fruits harvest of the church, which you were a part of. But one focuses upon Christ's role to make it all possible as our new high priest with the wave sheaf ceremony on Wave Sheaf Sunday, whereas The 49 count of Deuteronomy 16 focuses on you and me and our role in that first fruit work. It is all incredibly glorious. It is an inspiration. And we are blessed indeed that God continues to inspire, even through a small remnant, to fulfill his promise that the gates of hell will never prevail against that church. He will bring it successfully to a conclusion at his second coming. And if we're willing to fulfill our role, especially to hear and to respond to that faith which was delivered by Jesus Christ with authority through chosen servants of the past, and if we hold on to that and we keep fighting for it, then we can have that great glorification which he desires to give to us. You are some of the most blessed people on the face of the earth because of your understanding and, again, your participation in the observance of this high holy day of Pentecost.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented The Significance of Two Counts, a message by Mr. John Brisby for the afternoon service of the Day of Pentecost, Monday, May 29th, 2023.